Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with journalist and author Melanie Phillips. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. In Psalm 118, verse 22, it is stated, "The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone." That builder stone, the one in the corner, the base, the foundation, is so often forgotten and ignored, buried below the magnificent structure that towers above it. But there's only one problem. If you take away the stone, the entire edifice crumbles. Today, that stone is our Judeo-Christian values. And the castle is Western civilization, a once towering civilization of exquisite grandeur that is now crashing down upon itself. Melody Phillips' book, The Builder's Stone, is a commentary and a scathing indictment of the suicidal trajectory of a faithless, godless society. You don't have to convert or even go to church or synagogue to adopt Judeo-Christian values. These are the values of civilized people. That's why they call it civilization. Melanie Phillips is a British journalist, author, broadcaster, and Substacker, known for her conservative commentary and critiques of progressive politics. She began her career at The Guardian before shifting from left-wing views to a more socially conservative stance. Currently, she writes a weekly column for The Times of London and contributes to the Jewish Chronicle, Jewish News Syndicate. Just briefly, you have many books, including, how do you pronounce this, Londonistan?
Londonistan,
yes. Londonistan, The World Turned Upside Down, and her most recent masterpiece, The Builder's Stone. Thank you so much for joining me, Melanie. It truly is a tremendous honor to be sitting here with you today. If we could begin with a little insight into who you are. Since October 7th, 2023, I think that all Jews reconciled, in one way or another, their personal relationship to Judaism and with God. How would you say that Judaism has formed and informed your life, and has that changed at all since October 7th?
It's changed a lot over the years. I was born and bred in London. My family was a Jewish-British family, typical of the time. I was brought up as a child in the 50s and 60s, and we belonged to an Orthodox synagogue, but we were not tremendously observant. We were kosher at home and out, but my parents went to synagogue approximately three times a year on the high holy days. We did not observe the Sabbath in any meaningful way. And I went every Sunday to Hebrew classes, where I think I received a very rudimentary Jewish education. And I didn't really know how rudimentary it was until very much later in my life, when I realized how ignorant I was of Judaism, its history, and its key precepts. I was brought up with a love of Judaism, nevertheless, love of the Jewish people, an awareness that being Jewish was different from the rest of Britain and something to be proud of. I had never been to Israel. My parents never flew anywhere. My father had a flying phobia,
okay,
which I inherited, and I had to overcome it over many years. And so I didn't actually go to Israel until the year 2000, which we can talk about. And now I mainly live in Jerusalem. So work that one out. Over time, my whole way of looking at the world changed very considerably. I worked for Guardian newspapers for about 20 years. So at the very heart of the liberal establishment, the liberal cultural establishment. And for half of that time, I was in a kind of internal exile, because I reached the conclusion that the people that I thought were on my side in standing for things like justice and truth, standing up for the oppressed, standing up against abuses of power, telling truth to power. All the good things in that we call civilized. I came to the conclusion quite early on in my career at The Guardian that they were on the other side. And this was a shattering discovery. And it changed my life, as you may imagine. And I started writing in that way. And then I was cancelled long before the word was ever invented.
Right.
And over time, my attitude to Judaism also changed because I realised how ignorant I was, how the assumptions I'd made were based in ignorance. I'd been ignorant of the history of the Middle East. I was ignorant of the history of the Jewish people in the Middle East. I knew vaguely, but not in detail. And when I came to understand the detail of the history of the Jews in the Middle East, it was only then that I began to understand the full monstrosity of the lie that was being told about Israel. And I'm talking about well before October 7, 2023. I'm talking about going back into the 80s, 1980s.
Wow.
And obviously earlier than that too. And then my attitude towards the religion started to change as well. And I realized how little I knew. And then I realized how much there was and to admire and to make me feel better about myself, to improve the way I lived, the way I felt about living. My whole attitude to life changed. And I wouldn't say I'm free of questions at all. I think that, you know, if previously I was an agnostic, I think I'm now agnostic about being agnostic, if you see what I mean. The more I find out, the more questions I have, which I think is itself a very Jewish thing.
I was just about to say that. Very
Judaism does not provide answers. It only provides questions.
Okay. And it welcomes questions.
It absolutely
which is unique
questions.
Among it, the religions.
It is, from that point of view, supremely inclusive and open-minded, mm-hmm. which, again, people don't think about. People don't associate.
Sure.
So I've been on what's called a journey. And I consider myself still to be on a journey, both in terms of political, ideological attitudes and in terms of attitudes to religion.
Yeah, I think that's amazing because honestly, just to reiterate, Judaism is probably the only religion, or at least the only major religion, that not only allows you to question God, but encourages it because to seek is to look in earnest for meaning rather than blind faith. And so your agnosticism in some ways brings you closer to God, I would say, than many of the very religious people who don't even question why they've always said or done or thought the things that they've always been told to say and done and think.
Right. Yes. Yes, I think that's right. If you don't question, then you're not really having a proper, meaningful engagement with what you're not questioning. Blind authority or blind submission way, it's precisely the opposite. I mean, the Jews are probably the most quarrelsome people on the earth. So quarrelsome that in the Torah we read that the Almighty himself despaired of the Jewish people as being absolutely dreadful people.
Oh.
everybody else was worse.
Okay, I'll take it. So you use words that are very similar to words that I use about your professional trajectory and having once been in a much more I hate the word progressive because I really think it's very regressive I know it's sort of funny, but it's like what I call funny, not funny, right? Like there's
exactly.
Nothing progressive about progressive thinking anymore. And so as a yoga instructor, right, I've been so deeply ensconced in the woke catechism, right, of love and light. And I have to be honest that my whole world shattered after 10/7. It really did. And it broke me in a million little pieces, not just what happened to the people of Israel, but what I saw happening in my own community. And I don't even know how to term it other than Like, the reaction has been savage, demonic, and these are like the self-proclaimed good people of the world. And the way that they've come out against Israel and against the Jewish people, even being in this fight for decades, has come as a total shock to me. It does every single day. But as you said, you've been thinking about this, but you've also actually been writing about this phenomenon for decades. What did you see even back then that the rest of us seem to have missed?
I would date this journey, the start of this journey, to 1982, when I was at The Guardian, and when I realized that there was a double standard being used in the attitude to Israel, which was hateful. And not just hateful, but was based on a set of outright lies, which clearly were demonstrably untrue and flew in the face of all available evidence and facts, and were based on a malice towards both Israel and the Jewish people. And I realized that this attitude was being sort of almost a kind of signature motif defining the claim to compassion and conscience by people who I assumed had stood for compassion and conscience. And that was a remarkable realization, because it was the realization of what in fact explains what you're describing, which is not just an eruption of attitudes which are horrible and hateful, not even just a situation in which people are telling the falsehoods of propaganda, propaganda issued by the Hamas, by the Palestinian Authority, by the Palestinian Arabs generally, by the Muslim world and so on. It's more than that. The discombobulation that you're describing, that we've all felt, some of us longer than others, but certainly since October 7 and the reaction of the West, has been caused by the fact that everything is inside out, that people are being racist and bigoted towards Jews, more than that, are expressing a savage hatred of Jews and of Israel, which it not only turns truth and lies inside out, but on which they hang their claim to be morally good people and to be people of conscience. And if you look at the liberal world, it's erected this edifice of what I would call the humanitarian establishment based on what's called human rights. So what are we talking about? We're talking about the transnational institutions and laws which are held to trump national institutions and laws, because national institutions and laws belong to the nation. The nation, the Western nation, is to be illegitimate, founded in oppression and war and colonialism and so on. The Western nation is therefore the center of division. It's a cause of division and prejudice and war. What we have to have instead, according to this thinking, is the brotherhood of man, nations coming together. If nations coming together, it's the brotherhood of man. That is essentially good. And so you have transnational institutions and laws which are good, which are, if you found in the United Nations, in international courts such as the International Criminal Court, International Court of Justice, European Court of Human Rights, the whole edifice of human rights law, the great NGOs that stand for all these things, Amnesty, NGO, Human Rights Watch, and that these are unchallengeable because they stand for the brotherhood of man, the community of nations, and so embody good things to do with fairness and justice and right and compassion, standing up for the oppressed. And the point is they all stand for the precise opposite. Just as the kind of people you're talking about and the kind of people I encountered first or realized first in 1982 actually stand for the opposite. They are spouting every day pure bigotry and hatred and lies and demonization the demonization of Israel and the Jewish people, which are, it's basically, it constitutes a narrative which is deranged. And we last saw it under the Nazis, because that was their narrative, in which you take truth and lies, you turn it inside out. And that also reflected the Soviet Union, where you fry people's brains because they can no longer understand that they are not just seeing the world wrongly, but they cannot see it in the right way round, because everything has been flipped in their minds, so that black is white, truth are lies. Truth is lies. And so this is, you know, this is what I've written about in my book. And I explain in my book how I have come to explain it to myself. I mean, what has caused this? What could possibly have caused this? And it's been caused by, in my view, well, there are many factors which have gone to make this up. It's a complicated story. I've tried to unpick it in the book. But the single most key core factor is that at some point, Western world decided to turn against itself, because it turned against and lost the biblical foundations of its culture. It told itself that its culture was rubbish and wrong, and insofar as there was a biblical component, that was rubbish and wrong, because religion is terrible, it oppresses people, it's authoritarian, it stands for all bad things. And consequently, we've seen a Western world which has gradually becoming godless. And if you take away the scaffolding of a culture, it collapses. And the scaffolding was biblical values. Okay, we all know the Greeks played a considerable part. They, you know, ancient Greece has contributed a great deal to Western civilization. But if you look at the trajectory of what we call modernity, where do you date modernity from? Most people would date it from the 18th century Enlightenment. If you look at all the thinking that came from the Enlightenment and subsequently, you can see a whole train of, or tributaries of thinking, which came from the Enlightenment, which led us, as the West, into a very dark place. You could trace it through the French Revolution, which was supposedly to usher in the age of reason, where religion was put to one side, and in the French bit of the Enlightenment, they wanted to destroy it completely, but put to one side, so that reason, the age of reason, would make us enlightened, and all good things would follow from that. And what flowed from that was the French Revolutionary Terror. And from that, you had a line going through, you can trace the line going through Soviet communism into Nazi fascism and into what I think we're living through now, which is secular cultural totalitarianism. You're not allowed to think anything other than the liberal view. And consequently, it's a world that's been turned upside down and back to front, and it's making everybody very confused because it's hijacked language. So words like justice and compassion and anti-racism and stuff like that are thrown around, but they mean the opposite of what they actually are. Sure. One can't imagine a more racist, bigoted set of views than those being deployed at the moment by people who call themselves progressive, liberal, compassionate, and so on, against the Jews and against Israel.
They don't just call themselves. I can honestly and do honestly believe that they think they stand for goodness.
They do.
And that's like the Orwellian element of all this.
Exactly.
And everything that you just said was written by George Orwell in 1948. And it's funny that you came to us in the early 80s, because of course his book was called 1984, and Was He a Prophet? It really is astounding. So the human rights movement has, it's gone so wrong. But how can it be restructured in a way that truly reflects the humanistic values that its acolytes claim to uphold?
Well, it has to understand what it's done to itself, and that it has to understand that it's done it because it has denied biblical values, which are essentially Jewish values, the most important of which are the understanding that there is such a thing as truth, and that there are rules that a civilized society has to follow to become civilized. Those rules are in the Hebrew Bible. They were put into the West through Christianity, but they are from the Hebrew Bible. It's not surprising, therefore.
What rules? Could you give a few of the rules?
I was going to say, it's not surprising that a society that's turned on itself and its core values has turned so badly on the Jewish people and on the state of Israel. What are those core values? Well, moral responsibility, taking responsibility for your own actions, dividing truth from lies, understanding the difference. Well, for moral responsibility is you understand the difference between a victim and an aggressor, and you understand that you have to defeat the aggressor through justice and support the victim, but you understand which is which. The idea that, you know, you put other people's interests before your own, which is the essence of community, that what creates a society, what creates a set of people that march together in a kind of shared common purpose, which creates a society, that is based not on rights, but on duty. Judaism is all about duty and responsibility. The idea of rights, which is what the post-religious, post-biblical world tells itself, is the acme of progressivism. Rights are simply demands. Rights are selfishness. Rights are what I demand of you. I have a right that you have to give me. Mm-hmm. You have to deliver to me. It's all about me, and what we've lost is the we. It's all about I rather than we. Now, the Bible is all about we. It's about duty and responsibility. From those networks of duty and responsibility enforced by self-policing rules of behavior, mm-hmm. then you get the upholding of one of the core precepts of the Hebrew Bible, which is that you respect every human being because every human being is made in the image of God. If you basically say God is dead, then you have no reason to respect every human being. And then it becomes all about power. Who has power? It is the strong versus. And of course, the strong will win. That's mm-hmm. the kind of a society we're living in. We're living in a society which says human rights. It sounds wonderful, but actually it's demands, and demands are made by groups. Groups form themselves into groups to demand their rights. And then you have group against group. You have social division. You have unfairness and injustice. That's what we're living through, all in the name of progressivism and brotherhood of man type thinking and making a better world and being compassionate. It's all the opposite, because we've got rid of the moral scaffolding which came from the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, I'll actually argue that atheism is in of itself a certain kind of narcissism. And I know you actually touch upon this in your book as well. I don't think you actually use the word narcissism, though I might have missed it. But narcissism is the buzzword of the day, right? It's amazing that if you go on YouTube, the number one narcissist expert started off by saying 1-2% of, you know, the world is narcissistic. And she just got so much traction. And now her whole thing is like, everyone's a narcissist. But they are. I mean, even in the yoga world, the concept of self-care has become so much about, like, literally putting yourself in front of others rather than the old concept of take care of yourself so you could take care of others. That if you don't believe there is a higher source of power greater than yourself, then of course you're going to believe in this selfish, entitled concept of self.
Yeah, it's not just about even about entitlement in the sense of wanting stuff. Mm-hmm. It's all about the self, so that it's all about the subjective. There's no such thing as the objective. There's no such thing as objective truth. There's no such thing as objective reality from that.
Sure.
It's all about how I feel, how I think. How I feel is how I am. What I want to be, I can be whatever I want to be. Mm-hmm. I make my own reality. And how I feel about things trumps what you say are facts. Mm-hmm. Don't give me the facts. I feel. I feel that you are oppressing me. Why do I feel that? Because I'm part of a victim group, defined however you want, black, gay, woman, whatever. I'm part of the victim group. You are the oppressor group. You are white, male, whatever. So the fact that I have punched you on the nose does not make me a bad person, and it does not make me the aggressor because I'm a victim. Mm-hmm. It's your fault mm-hmm. that I punched you on the nose because you are the oppressor. You can do no right because you are the oppressor group and you have power. I am powerless. I am therefore a victim. I therefore can do no wrong. If I punch you on the nose, it's your fault. I cannot be held responsible. That's how it works. It's completely mad. But it works on a personal level in terms of what we call victim culture, mm-hmm. intersectionality. You can't hold people in those groups responsible for anything bad they may do. And it works on a global scale. Mm-hmm. Israel cannot do anything right because mm-hmm. it's an oppressor society. Why? Well, because it is colonialist and it took someone's land away from them. Well, no, that is a lie. It is the Jews alone who are the people for whom Israel was ever their national kingdom. Zionism is the ultimate decolonization exercise. So get over that for a start, please. It's also the case that Jews are held to be the oppressor class. And Israel is held to be oppressor. Why? Because Jews and Israel are white. No, actually, the majority of Jews in Israel are brown-skinned. The majority of Israel's population is brown or black-skinned. Okay, well, Jews are oppressive because they are white because they have power. Okay, we've all heard that lunacy before, but they're not actually white. And what do you mean they have power? Well, they have power because Jews run the world, don't they? They run finance, they run the media, they run Hollywood, they run the law, they have the American governments, successive American governments in their pockets. They are basically a force that controls the world in their own interests to the advantage of everybody else. Excuse me? How many people are in the world? How many Jews are in the world? They are a microscopic proportion of the world. They are the most literally, genuinely oppressed people in the history of the planet. There is no people, culture, or group that has been persecuted, slaughtered, annihilated, discriminated against as the Jews have been. So what are you talking about? The whole thing is completely upside down because of this idea that everything is organized on the basis of power. Yeah. Powerful, powerless. And it's ultimately a Marxist concept. People who adhere to this kind of way of thinking, most of them are not Marxists, they would laugh at the idea. But it comes from Marx. And Marx was the ultimate anti-Semite. Born a Jew, mm-hmm. but his perfect society had not one Jew in it. And you can hear it in what we're all living through, this onslaught on the Jewish people and the state of Israel.
The very concept of a world where it would be a better place without Jews in and of itself is its own travesty, especially in a world that falls over itself to show how tolerant and kind and
okay.
loving.
Okay, so this is complete nonsense on many levels. But one evidence of this inversion is what the so-called progressive anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian world tells itself. Mm-hmm. Signature complaints is about what they call the settlers. Mm-hmm. These are Israelis who live in the disputed territories of Judea and Samaria, otherwise called the West Bank.
Right.
It is said that they are illegal. This is actually not true, but the real point is this. The animus against them is the idea that they shouldn't be there. Why? Because it's land which will be and should be, according to these people, a state of Palestine, right? Mm-hmm. So the settlers, are so-called, are in the way of a state of Palestine, and they have no right to be there, therefore. Just think about that for a minute. The settlers are Jews. Why can't Jews live in a state of Palestine?
Exactly.
What's wrong with that?
That's right. How many Arabs live in the state of Israel?
20% of Israel are Arabs. And yet the progressive liberal says not one Jew should be in a state of Palestine. Those settlers have no right to live there. They must be removed. And the fact that they are there means there cannot be a state of Palestine. So those progressive liberals want an ethnically cleansed, ethnically pure state. That's what they're arguing for, right? So what do you mean? What does a progressive mean? I'm a progressive person. You're not a progressive person. You're a racist. You're a racist ethnic cleanser. Don't give me this business about you being progressive and moral. You are the opposite of what you claim to be. So that's what we're living through. And we should be saying this to those people.
Right. As they say, tell me what you accuse the Jews of and I'll tell you what you're guilty of.
Precisely.
I heard something by Ruth Weiss.
Ruth Weiss,
yesterday that was so remarkable that she said, next time somebody says to you, like, what about apartheid in Israel? She said, I just say to them, why did you kill your grandmother? And they're like, you didn't hear my question. She's like, yes, I did. Why did you kill your grandmother? And she goes to the group, why did he kill his grandmother? And he's like, you know, this isn't true. And you're diverting from the question. She's like, no, I'm not. You're doing the same thing. You perpetrate a lie enough times and people just start to believe it. And I just did it right there. And it was quite a remarkable, I've never heard anybody say that way before.
Well, indeed. Yes, you perpetrate a lie and you say it long enough and then it becomes believed. That is true. But the real lie is what these people tell themselves.
Yep.
They tell themselves, I'm a good person because I'm progressive, because I support good things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it has to say to them and say it in public so that they are held to account in public that they are the very thing they hate.
Mm-hmm.
They are the very thing they purport to be against. And it's not just hypocrisy. They are that evil thing.
Yeah, that's right. So you actually wrote in a recent Substack article, I'm sorry that I didn't write down the name of the article, but that the human rights movement has a doctrine of infallibility. Maybe ironic, maybe not, that Islam has the same doctrine, by the way, right? You can't even criticize them without losing your head in literally, unfortunately. So what happens, like, when one group declares itself the sole purveyor of righteous and morality, and then they take over the world narrative? It's exactly what we're seeing.
That's what we're living through. And it is a terrifying situation because it's so omnipresent and it's literally totalitarian. You can't sort of get out of it because you're dealing with a totally closed thought system. By definition, mm-hmm. it thinks of itself as unchallengeable because it's moral and good. And so if you are opposing it, if someone is opposing that, they're not just wrong, they're evil. So you can't get into it because by definition, if you, the progressive person, stand for all good things and you stand for sanity and central, you know, middle of the road types, stuff, then anyone who challenges you is by definition evil and extreme, and you cannot believe a word they say because it must be wrong, it must be a lie.
Right.
So this is very difficult. All we can do, those of us who understand what's going on, all we can do and what we must do is keep on keeping on.
Mm-hmm.
We must keep on putting out into the public domain as far as we can and every way we can what the truth of the situation is, but also we must do what our side doesn't do. Our side generally plays defense.
Mm-hmm.
In the Jewish mm-hmm. world, we say, it's not true. We are the victims. Can't you see how many hundreds and thousands of rockets we had, etc.? Once you start playing defense, you've lost the argument because you're in the territory that's been defined by your enemy. what we should be doing is going from the back foot onto the front foot, mm-hmm. and holding these people to account in terms that they understand that they are the opposite of what they say they are, mm-hmm. And that they are putting out stuff which is lies, which is bigotry, which is vicious, which is dehumanizing, which is murderous, and so on. And we should be naming and shaming. I mean, you know, identifying mm-hmm. them by name, by group, governments, and our side doesn't do that.
Yeah, and I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. So you argue in this book, The Boulder Stone, that the Judeo-Christian religions need a PR makeover, but PR is only as effective as the outlets that will carry it mm. and the people who are willing to consume it. Mm. Now, that being said, if we take a look at Hamas's winning PR strategy, and sickeningly enough, it's winning.
For sure.
Okay, it involved massacring 1,200 people, kidnapping 250 more than 250, raping, maiming, and torturing thousands more, and then parading the hostages that were finally released in horrible deals, both alive and murdered, in, like, honestly, what was a macabre circus of the most heinous depravity imaginable. And in the pro-Israel community, I think, like, we thought, okay, they're doing the PR for us, right? Now the world's going to wake up. Now the world is going to understand. Yeah, you laugh, right? Because they didn't, not even a little bit. So assuming Judaism and Christianity got the best PR makeover ever, who is there to listen when this is what they respond to?
Well, the PR makeover is not the end of the story. It's only part of the beginning of the story. What I'm talking about in the book is the need to get the West to understand that it's made a terrible misstep, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But to get the West to understand that the West, is going off the edge of the cultural mm-hmm. cliff. It's made a vacuum of its own identity and values, and into which is coming the Islamist, mm-hmm. radical Muslims, mm-hmm. who understand that without religion, a society will not defend itself because it doesn't even know what it is anymore. And we can see the evidence of this all over. And that's precisely what Israel is fighting. So how to get the West to understand this and to pull itself back from the edge of the cultural cliff, if it can, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd leave that question open, whether sure. it can. But if it has a chance, then this is the way I think it should do it. It has to understand that it has done this terrible damage to itself by evacuating of meaning what it itself stands for. It has done that by basically disdaining and trying to destroy and remove from its consciousness the biblical values on which it is based, mm-hmm. and substituted instead a load of other values, mm-hmm. universalist, mm-hmm. To cut a very long discussion very short, universalist values, which are leading it off the edge of the cliff. Mm-hmm. Now, if it has got to understand that and to put that right, how is it going to do that? Well, if it hates religion so much, it's never going to do that, because it's going to say, well, we're not going back to that, because that is the source of all bad things in the world. So that's what I mean by religion needing to have mm-hmm. a makeover. One of the things that people tell themselves is that only stupid people do religion. Smart people know that religion is bunk because it's superstitious, mumbo jumbo and all the rest of it, okay? Well, in fact, some of the smartest people around are religiously affiliated, and they say smart things about it. And some of the dumbest people around are atheists, who say some of the most stupid things in order to try to rationalize what they cannot actually rationalize, because they're trying to argue several things that don't add up in often very comical ways. They're so absurd. Mm-hmm. So that I mean by religion having a makeover, you have to start speaking about it in positive terms. Mm-hmm. and showing people how important those religious values are in creating what, as you rightly say, are civilized values, mm-hmm. i.e. values that everybody who is a civilized person signs up to, whether you're religious or non-religious, whatever group you come from, you sign up to those values. And people take them for granted. They think that they're kind of imprinted in our DNA, we're born with them, and that they're universal. Well, they're mm-hmm. not universal.
No.
Virtually, I mean, there, you know, other cultures don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
The culture that invented them is the West. Why? Because it was based on biblical values. So that's what I mean. You have to unravel that way of thinking. In order to unravel it, you know, religion, it would be nice if religion had a better PR. You
mm-hmm.
start talking about it in ways that people can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not some set of difficult and onerous rules. It's actually a way, hello people, of making you feel better about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're living through a world where there are record amounts of psychological distress, particularly among young people. Okay, many reasons for that. Not trying to say that there aren't good clinical reasons for specific mental, psychological illnesses mm-hmm. and diseases and ailments. But nevertheless, it's quite obvious to me and to many others that at the root of that is a sense of rootlessness, of feeling powerless, of feeling that you're just a, you know, you're just a bag of atoms whirling through space, and you're at the prey of random events. There's nothing you can do about them, and meaningless in your life, meaninglessness in your life. People are searching all the time for a meaning. You can see that they are going in all different directions to try and find meaning in their lives. So here is, you know, a way in which you can make yourself feel a lot better. This is actually a way mm-hmm. to live which has not been bettered in giving you a sense of purpose, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of belonging, creating communities which are communities that produce civilized values
mm-hmm.
that are good for everybody. It has not been bettered. So shouldn't we be getting back to that? That's the approach that I think one should take. For that, you need leadership. You need the kind of leadership that takes this overview and that appeals to people on their self-interest. It's good for you and it's good for everybody if
right.
we go down this road rather than go off the edge of that cultural cliff.
And it has been proven that people who have a stronger belief in God, I'm not talking about a specific God, tend to be happier. Like people
they
in
do.
The Judean Christian faith.
They do.
That the closer you are to faith, the more you can deal with hardship, challenge.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, in resilience. And
exactly.
And so you actually, in your book, talk specifically, people are so desperate, as you just said, to find meaning in their lives, because without that connection, we're firing synapses more than anything. But that human rights has become the new religion
quite.
Of the left. And it's made this, I love how you say, it's created this like perverse metamorphosis into what you call a God-shaped hole. And I'm wondering, when did this hole form in Western society? Was it in the 80s, like you said? And what is the real danger besides unhappiness or being lost of a godless society?
Well, a godless society's danger is that that people turn on each other. You become brutalized. And we are.
Mm-hmm.
We're turning on each other. We're losing all sense of order, orderliness, that we are bound by rules called laws, both informal laws and laws passed by parliaments and governments. We become a society driven by selfishness and self-centeredness. So we become a cruel, cruel society. And we have been. We have become very cruel. And indifferent to suffering. And that's increasing. Also stupid, becoming irrational. I mean, the idea that, you know, you get rid of God and you become rational, one of the fastest growing movements is witchcraft. Go
figure. Very rational.
Paganism, witchcraft. I mean, this is absurd. So internally, you destroy civilization internally. Externally, because you no longer have a shared sense of purpose, you no longer have a national identity, you no longer have a cultural identity, the West. Mm-hmm. Insofar as there is one, you think it's dreadful, you think it's so ghastly that it has to be removed. So you're not prepared to defend yourself. And the real enemies from outside, whether they are the Islamic Republic of Iran, Russia, China, North Korea, they can all see the West is there for the taking. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is prey upon their vulnerabilities, their weaknesses, which we understand better than they do, mm-hmm. and we've got them. Sure. And that's what's happening. So that's what happens.
It's what happened on October 7th.
Absolutely.
Israel was in turmoil, and anybody who is paying attention is like, guys, something bad is going to happen if you keep eating yourself from the inside.
Well, I think that what October 7 did was to throw down a challenge to the world. Do you support civilization or barbarism? And they did not support civilization. That's what it's shown us, because they no longer know what civilization is, and they no longer understand that the West invented it.
So let me step in here, because when I heard you say that, that was such a light bulb moment for me. Mm-hmm. I repeated it to one of my open-minded liberal friends, and they took tremendous offense to it. Like, well, what about Eastern civilization? What about so? How do you answer that?
First of all, there are different civilizations. I think the word is being used differently, you see.
Sure.
There's Western civilization, there's Eastern civilization, there is Islamic civilization, there is Chinese civilization. I mean, mm-hmm. you can have an adjective to describe civilization,
sure.
Which is particular to that culture. But what we call civilized values, which I would say respect for every human life, mm-hmm. Compassion, mm-hmm. Justice, rule of law, one rule of law that everybody adheres to. Mm-hmm. There are other fundamental values. These are not found in other civilizations. The idea that Eastern civilizations are compassionate, that they value human life like we do, they are committed to the rule of law, to political freedom. Mm-hmm. Excuse me? Where mm-hmm. are these people living? I mean, the people who are talking to you and mm-hmm. saying, what about mm-hmm. other civilizations? Mm-hmm. This is one of the crucial ways in which the West has lost the plot. This mm-hmm. idea it's told itself that if you say that the West is better than any other civilization, then you're racist. Well, excuse me? I happen to think that equality for women, freedom of religion, putting other people above yourself, you know, compassion, justice, other stuff like that, I happen to think they are better yeah. than places which don't have them.
Sure.
I mean, to say that that is racist is precisely why the West is destroying itself.
That's right.
Because it's becoming as brutal as other societies.
Yeah. All day long when I make arguments like either you support the fight up against terror or you support terror. Like this is the war we're facing. And everyone's like, you only talk in terms of black and white. I'm like, this is black and white. In the world, black and white happen to exist. That's why we have words for black and white. And
yeah.
there is the moral relativism that is being applied to only this one situation, of course, because the double, or as John Spencer calls it, triple standards that are applied to the Jews and to Israel are so ludicrous. But what's interesting is that this same cultural relativism of like, oh, we're all equal, we're all good, the brotherhood of man, directly conflicts with their own belief that they are the ultimate authority
Absolutely.
On goodness and kindness. And
Absolutely.
It's like, how do you square that circle?
Absolutely.
How do you say that our beliefs, and by the way, they think of themselves as being open-minded
yeah.
when they are as closed-minded as the furthest right person who At least myths are closed-minded.
They have a sealed, totally sealed thought system.
That's right.
I mean, I've said this many times as an anecdote, but in 1982, when I first discovered the shattering realization, the people I thought were on my side, at the Guardian newspaper, the thing that brought it to a head was my saying to them in all innocence, because I was a different kind of person then, mm-hmm, thought different things, mm-hmm, why do we have a double standard when it comes to Israel? Israel, which was in a really very difficult and probably ill-advised war in Lebanon at that time, when it kills Palestinians, who it was going after because Lebanon was where the Palestine Liberation Organization, terrorist organization, had set up, mm-hmm, its headquarters. And so Israel was trying, as a matter of self-defense, to stop the attacks coming at it. And it was at war in Lebanon against the PLO. And so when Israel killed just a few Palestinian Arabs in Lebanon, there was a front page splash, and there was outraged editorials and outraged op-eds. Whereas in Syria, where President Assad, who was the father of the guy who just recently left, deposed, he caused to be killed between 10 and 40,000 of his political opponents over, I think, the course of 2 weeks.
Right.
And it was like, so what? It was a foreign news story and nobody said anything. So I said, why is there a double standard? And they all went, well, of course there's a double standard, because the developing world doesn't have the values that we have. It's not brought up to believe in human rights and sacredness of human life and so on. But we are brought up to think that. And so we can't judge them by our standards. That's racism. I say, what are you telling me? That if you are born into the developing world, you're not entitled to the same right, life right. and liberty as we are.
Right.
In my view, that's racism.
Exactly.
And what then came out was that they said, well, you know, you, the Jews,
yeah.
I became you at that point.
Yeah.
I stopped being we, I became you.
Okay.
You tell us that you're more moral than us and you share our values, mm-hmm. but you're even more so. So why are you getting so upset about this? They couldn't see that what mm-hmm. they had said was
pure racism. That's right.
Because their whole mindset was, we can't judge because we are superior to them, mm-hmm. and we can't therefore judge them because we are superior. And we can't hold them to our standards, which, I mean, what they're saying was, you know, we cannot expect the developing world to have civilized standards and to stop murdering each other because they're just the developing world.
Right.
To me, that was pure racism.
Sure.
They were the left. They were the progressives. That's what they stand for. That's what they stood for. That's what they stand for. We hear this every day.
Right.
We cannot say your friend, your ex-friend said to you, you know, what about the Eastern religions?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that friend is, put it mildly, deluded if he or she thinks other cultures have the same civilized standards that the West does.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are really trying to maintain that they are all on the same moral level, then they have absolutely no appreciation, understanding, or support for civilized values. They are not
sure.
themselves supporting civilized values.
Of course, I have to agree. So here we find ourselves in a world where the largest segment of society considers itself a... Have you heard about the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S?
No.
Oh, okay. It's when you check the box, are you Christian, Jewish, Buddhist?
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
So they're the nuns. But also, it's in the too much information category, but if you go on online dating, everybody calls and considers themselves spiritual, but not religious.
And oh, yes. Uh-huh.
To be honest, none of them is spiritual either. All they mean is that they're not religious, but they want to posture as if there's something deeper to who they are. Believe me, I've met them. They're not spiritual. So I'm wondering, like, so how much is this like religious rejectionism to blame for the empathetically suicidal, to take a term from Gadsad, in autoimmune disorder, to take a term from you, which very we're all talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
But how much is this blatant rejection of religion to blame for the autoimmune disorder that is currently plaguing the free world?
I think it's fundamental. I think it's fundamental because the inability to distinguish friend from foe, which is basically what autoimmune disorder is, you mm-hmm. embrace your foe mm-hmm. and you just try and destroy your friend or your ally, which is what we're all living through. It comes from ultimately from the destruction of the idea of objective reality, mm-hmm. objective truth, objective mm-hmm. reality. Everything is a matter of feeling. Everything is a matter of subjective opinion. And it's, I think that's at the root of this lethally mortal confusion mm-hmm. that we're all living through. And again, you know, we've said it before, you've made passing reference to this, but it's very much emphasized in my book. I am certainly not saying that anybody should become a religious person. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying people should convert to religion. I'm not saying people should convert to Judaism. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm saying that there are plenty of people already in this category, people who have no religious faith, but who get it, mm-hmm. who understand that the basis of the values in the society they hold dear are religious values, and that if you set out to destroy that the basis of that culture, which is based on religion, then we're all basically not just lost sheep, the victim at the mercy of a society in which the strong are going to come for the weak and destroy them. And so there are plenty of people who believe that. And so what I'm saying in the book is that in every grouping that one can think of, whether it's a social or cultural or ethnic grouping, black and white, women and men, gay and straight, left and right, whether it's people who are Christians or Jews or Muslims, in every single one of those groupings and ethnicities, mm-hmm. there are people who get it. There are people who understand that the West is unique in its greatness in having civilized values, both political and social and individual, and that those rest upon the Hebrew Bible and the Christianity that imbued the West with those values. In every one of those groupings, there are people who get it and who want to uphold it. People of all religions and none, secular people, atheists, agnostics, they all get it. And in every one of those groupings, there are people who want to destroy the West, who want to destroy its values. And so what I'm saying in the book is that there should be a kind of countercultural resistance movement, a coalition of people from all those groups who get it, who want the West to survive, who love the West, want it to survive. And in various ways, I try and lay out a kind of rudimentary program of the way in which this could be done. They must come together in order to do this. Because you don't have to be a religious person to do it.
That's right.
You don't have to be of any ethnicity to do it. You just have to get it, and you have to understand that these values are A, what made the West great and wonderful and civilized, and B, where they come from.
That's right. I'm getting a warning that my battery is low, and I don't know why, because I fully charged it. It should last for hours, but... Okay, so we're closing in on an hour anyway. How are you doing on time?
Quite soon, we should pack up.
So I just want to ask you, to me, it feels like we've reached an inflection point, or I would say like a second inflection point in the fall of the West. I'm curious if you feel, like I do, that there can be a straight line drawn from the BLM riots of 2020 to the radical Islamists of today.
The Black Lives Matter movement was certainly a very important punctuation point, but I would date it back far beyond that, far earlier than that. Black Lives Matter didn't just arise out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It arose out of a whole way of thinking which was developing over many decades, which is basically anti-capitalist, anti-West, anti-white, anti-Jew, all those things going in Black Lives Matter, and all those things were evident from years back in various movements that had grown up, the whole growth of street-based disorder, anarchy, mob anarchy, mob violence, and the growth of a liberal establishment in the case of America, the Democratic Party, which didn't just wasn't just indifferent to it. It didn't just tolerate it. It endorsed it.
That's right.
It endorsed it as virtue, and that that was particular to America. Black Lives Matter, Democratic Party, the connection between the two, but the way in which the liberal stroke leftist establishment across the West has endorsed nihilism, violence, racist bigotry against white people on the basis that the West was born in the original sins of colonialism and imperialism. That goes back decades. And, you know, how far back do you want to go? I mean, I would date it back to, as I said before, the tributaries from the Enlightenment. But I would say there was the real punctuation point to me was the rise of Nazism and the Holocaust.
But don't you think that things have abated and come back since then? I just feel like the whole world changed from an American perspective with BLM, with this anarchy, honestly, and then this false sense of meaning in an inverted racism of its own.
The inverted racism was in all kinds of, I can't remember what they were called, but Black Studies was growing up in the 80s, 90s, long time previously.
Yeah.
And that was the narrative that the West was evil and white people were evil. And it was anti-racist to say white people were evil. That was that goes back a long time. I agree. The BLM movement was very significant in moving the dial, in moving the dial of acceptability of nihilistic violence on the streets and being anti-police and so on. So it was. I'm not saying for a moment it wasn't significant, and it had an impact on Britain as well. In that respect, it kind of legitimised street nihilism, mob rule. But the essence of that had been in evidence, and the mind-bending, mind-twisting appropriation of nihilistic, anti-Western, anti-white, racist thinking by people who called themselves progressive and liberal and advanced and rational and decent and moral and compassionate, that had been building for decades.
Yeah. And the Jews who always marched with and supported the black people became the ultra-white enemy.
Yes, because they have to be white because they have power. Why do they have power? Because they're Jews. Jews run the world. At the very heart of the Black Lives Matter movement, intersectionality, that whole victim culture, identity politics, the very heart of it is the idea that the Jews are not one of the oppressed, they're not like us because they run the world. At the very heart, therefore, of liberal orthodoxy today is profound Jew hatred. And everything follows from that.
Do you think this is based to some extent on a jealousy that we have been victimized more than any culture in the history of the world, but we don't dwell in our victimization? Rather, we rise,
partly,
not just rise from the ashes, but rise so far from the ashes.
I think that's got something to do with it. I've heard
people, other oppressed classes have not been able to.
Correct. I've heard people say completely deranged things. You Jews suck all the victimhood from the world and leave none for the rest of us. I mean, what? I mean, how crazy is that? But that's kind of, when you unpack it, that's kind of what you're talking about. They're jealous of the victim. But why are they jealous? Why are they jealous? What? Why do they want to be victims? The very interesting question. Why does anyone want to be a victim? Being a victim surely is a really bad thing,
right?
Really bad for you. Why do they want to be a victim? Because they think that being a victim means you can get away with it. And that's what they think about the Jews. They are the ultimate victims. Ultimately, they are ultimate people who have made an absolute mastery of getting away with it. What did they get away with? By being victims, by claiming to be victims. What are the Jews supposed to have got away with? By being terrible people. At the very heart of liberal orthodoxy is a bigotry and a viciousness towards the Jews, which can't be exaggerated. And it's knocked everyone off their moral compass completely.
100%. Okay, in respect for your time, which I don't
want. And your battery.
But I don't want to, I know, I keep looking. I don't want to do, but I'm going to do. Let me finish with one last question. And that is, what does Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
It means that the Jewish people are the eternal people. We've seen off every enemy. We'll see this lot off again. The people of Israel will live forever, and Israel will win this terrible war and will emerge stronger and better than ever before.
Amen and amen. Melanie, I honestly, this has been the honor of a lifetime. I can't thank you enough for sitting down with me today.
It's been my pleasure and privilege. Thank you for giving me your time.
Thank you so much. Am Yisrael Chai, as they say in the old country.